From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Yes, thanks very much, Ollie. Bit dark this afternoon here in South Manchester. Some bad weather coming in, maybe. I hope you've had a good Wednesday. Thanks for joining me, as always. Lovely to be with you. This is the Richie Allen Show. Got a news roundup for the next 30 minutes, and then a terrific guest for you. It's all happening here. Let's get on with it.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, today I'm going to revisit a story that we heard last year, about a year ago, in fact. I was joined by Sharon Gale, a remarkable woman, and it was a conversation that really kind of hit home with our listeners. I've never had so much correspondence after a show as when we met Sharon. Sharon and her ex-husband made national news back in 2001 when their daughter Charlotte died after becoming ill suddenly and visiting hospital several times. Her husband went on trial for shaken baby or shaken impact syndrome about 3 years later. It was rightly thrown out, but the consequences for Sharon and her family were extreme, to say the least. And we talked about that last year. We'll welcome her back today and we'll find out how she's getting on. But one of the things she's been doing since we last spoke with her is she's been speaking with and meeting with many mothers, women who are in the situation where they have found themselves dealing with social services and the police and have lost access to their own children. So we'll get into that with Sharon after we get an update from her this hour, and that'll be an extended conversation. Before we welcome Sharon to the programme, I'm going to summarise her story as she told it to us last year, and if you haven't heard it before, it'll blow your mind. Alright, so we'll do that on Wednesday's show. It is live, of course, on Fab Radio 2 on triggerwarning.tv, my own website richieallen.co.uk, and other platforms as well. And the programme is archived on Podomatic.com, iTunes and Spotify, where you can grab it, YouTube as well, if you've ever missed an episode. They're all there. When I say the worst miscarriages of justice that I've ever been exposed to as a presenter, Sharon Gale, there's no exaggeration there. I've interviewed Paul Hill and Jerry Conlon and people like that. They spent 16 years in prison for crimes they never committed in this country, in Guildford. And what happened to them was a disgrace. They eventually got justice of sorts and were compensated for it. What happened to Sharon Gale and her family is on a par with that. And Sharon Gale has never received any justice. And we'll, as I said, we'll get into it in around about a half an hour when we welcome her back to the programme. A very bright, very articulate, very plucky woman who has endured things that I don't think I could ever have coped with. Right, before that then, let's have a roundup. You might have heard Ollie Barrett there talking about Julian Assange. He was sentenced today to 50 weeks in jail for breaching his bail conditions. We saw the scenes a couple of weeks ago. Of course, the awful scenes of him being carried out of the Ecuadorian embassy. Spent years there, of course, basically claiming asylum there. You know this. He was in the embassy from 2012, I think, to avoid extradition to Sweden, because he always believed that he was in danger of being extradited to the United States. He denied the sexual assault allegations against him. But anyway, he was in Southwark Crown Court today facing sentencing because he admitted breaching bail conditions. He said, "I did what I thought at the time was right, and it was the best or perhaps the only thing that I could have done." Speaking for him, Mark Summers QC said his client was gripped by fears of rendition to the United States over the years because of his work with the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. As threats rained down on him from America, they overshadowed everything, said Mark Summers QC. Sentencing him, Judge Deborah Taylor told Julian Assange that it was difficult to envisage a more serious example of this particular offence. And I'll quote the judge. The judge said, "By hiding in the embassy, you deliberately put yourself out of reach while remaining in the UK. She said this had undoubtedly affected the progress of the Swedish proceedings. So his continued residence at the embassy and the attempts to bring him to justice cost taxpayers £16 million, she said as well. As he was taken down to the cells below, Assange raised a fist to his supporters. They raised their fists in solidarity with him and directed shouts of shame on you towards the court. Human rights campaigner and regular guest on this show, Peter Tatchell, told RT this afternoon, in his opinion, the sentence is excessive.
Well, first of all, let me say that quite clearly, Julian Assange did skip bail. That is a criminal offence, and he therefore should face some form of punishment. However, the near maximum sentence of 50 weeks is, in my view, excessive and disproportionate. According to law and sentencing guidelines, a near maximum sentence should only be applied if a person poses a risk to the public or has a history of previous serious convictions. Now, I think it's pretty clear that Julian Assange does not pose a risk to the public and he has no previous serious convictions. So therefore, in my view, this 50-week sentence is excessive, extreme and unjustified.
And unnecessary, of course. And it'll get even more serious for Julian Assange tomorrow because a request by the US to extradite him for the leaks, of course, the Iraq logs and everything else, that request by the US will be heard by a London court tomorrow. What they want to do, of course, is make an example of Assange and send a message out to every other would-be whistleblower. If you screw with us and embarrass us and leak information that shows us to be the monstrous cabal that we are, well, we'll come after you and we'll bury you. And that's what it's all about. Right, it's 10 minutes past the hour. This one won't go away. Jeremy Corbyn should provide a full explanation as to why he wrote the foreword to a book considered anti-Semitic. Who said that? Who's demanding a full explanation from Jezza? Well, it's the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. That's who. Because back in 2011, Corbyn wrote the foreword for a new edition of J.A. Hobson's book, Imperialism, A Study. This book was written in 1902. Corbyn wrote the foreword for the new edition eight or so years ago. So the Times ran a story this morning saying that the book is an outrage. It's got lots of anti-Semitic tropes in it, etc., etc. Labour says that Jeremy Corbyn completely rejects the anti-Semitic elements of the book. Anti-Semitism. Are you sick of it yet? Well, I am, a little bit. Anyway, here's a Sky News reporter, Tamara Cohen, herself Jewish. Why am I saying that? I'll tell you in a minute. Here's Tamara reporting on it with Adam Bolton earlier.
This is a book by John Hobson, a Victorian radical thinker, which was reissued 8 years ago. Jeremy Corbyn, then an obscure backbencher, wrote a glowing foreword saying it was brilliant, very controversial, but he thought it was very prescient. And essentially it talks about how imperialism was driven by European financial houses. And those financial houses, he says, were controlled by men of a singular and peculiar race, which have behind them many centuries of financial experience. And he also goes on to talk about the Rothschilds and a number of other sort of anti-Semitic tropes, which have been discussed quite a lot recently in the context of the Labour anti-Semitism debate. He doesn't mention during this foreword that Hobson was anti-Semitic, although I think it was pretty widely considered at the time. And he also does talk in this introduction about racist caricatures in the book of African and Asian people. So that is why a lot of Labour MPs are going to be deeply concerned about this and about why the response has been to defend it rather than to apologise for it.
Yeah, the reason I mentioned that Tamara is Jewish is because if I was Adam Bolton, I would have said, Tamara, I think you're Jewish. I think you're of the Jewish faith. And presumably Tamara would have said yes. I would have said, listen, does it bother you, this sort of stuff, you know, as somebody who is Jewish or of the Jewish faith, or do you not give a rat's arse? That's what I would have asked her, but they're not allowed to do that. That's why I mentioned she was Jewish. It's not relevant otherwise. Right, so there has been concern raised that some Labour folks are defending Corbyn and not apologising for him. Apparently people should be apologetic today. Because Hobson wrote in 1902 that finance in Europe was driven by men of a singular and peculiar race who have behind them many centuries of financial experience. He suggested that European countries would not engage in a war if the House of Rothschild and its connections set their face against it. So he suggested in 1902 that the Rothschild family were incredibly powerful and that basically what they wanted to happen was happening. If they didn't want war, there wouldn't be war, effectively, he said. Now, in the foreword in 2011, Corbyn praised the book's brilliant analysis of the pressures that were hard at work pushing for a vast national effort in grabbing new outposts of empire on distant islands and shores. He also described Hobson's railing against the commercial interests that fuel the role of the popular press with tales of imperial might that then lead on to racist caricatures of African and Asian peoples as correct and prescient. That was the bones of the foreword by Jeremy Corbyn, right? Now, Rebecca Long Bailey, very loud, Rebecca Long Bailey. She's a Labour MP, staunch Corbyn file, and she was on Sky Breakfast with Sarah Jane Mee today to defend Corbyn against this article in the Times. Rebecca Long Bailey.
Jeremy, you know, he's already said yesterday, in no way, you know, supports or sanctions the words that were used in relation to anti-Semitism.
So why did he write a glowing forward for this book?
He was writing in the context of, I think, Hobson being, you know, a political thinker of his time, in the same way that other MPs have spoken about that same individual. But he in no way sanctions any. sanctions any anti-Semitic comments that are made by any individual, never mind that this particular individual.
In light of
that,
then, should he have written a foreword for the book?
Well, he was commenting on, in a wider political sense, as I understand. I haven't read the foreword myself, or indeed the book.
Well, it was a foreword to a book.
Well, I haven't read the foreword or the book, but he was commenting in a wider political sense, in the same way that many MPs have done over the last few years. I mean, this, you know, gentleman in question was a political thinker of his time, whether you agreed with his opinion or not. We know that numerous Labour and Conservative colleagues have commented on him, whether that's negatively or positively, taking certain parts of his thinking into consideration. But in no way would the Labour Party or Jeremy Corbyn condone any anti-Semitic comments of any kind.
You don't need to waterboard people to get information out of them. I would just put them in a room with Rebecca Long Bailey and Terry Christian. And after 5 minutes, the accused will give up his grandmother to get out of that room. She's got a big mouth, as Bailey. She's an awful, condescending, sneering woman, to be honest. A great example for Momentum and this progressive lunatic left that has come to the forefront of UK politics in recent years. Marvellous example, Bailey. Completely intolerable. At least for me, anyway. That's my opinion. So political commentators couldn't wait to jump on the hateful anti-Semite Jeremy Corbyn. They couldn't wait. Here's Lucy Fisher. She's the correspondent, the defence correspondent for The Times. It's her newspaper that broke this story that 8 years ago Jeremy wrote the foreword for a hateful anti-Semitic book. Here's Lucy Fisher of The Times.
I think what's interesting about this book by John Hobson, a classic tome on imperialism, is that there are two
classic
things.
Radical
tome, yeah. on imperialism, is that it tells us a lot about Corbyn's views in terms of the ways he might run the country, viewing the US as an anti-imperialist aggressor, as Venezuela as the main source of hope, as NATO as an occupying force. But of course, the real news value in this, and what's really genuinely shocking, is the fact that the book peddles a Jewish conspiracy theory, talking about Jewish financiers being the pressure behind Western and particularly British imperialism. And this is something that Jeremy Corbyn, in a foreword to a new edition of this book, has not even acknowledged at all and simply gone on to praise it as an amazing analysis.
But what if the claims made in the book by Hobson happen to be true? What if? We'll come back to that one. Here's City AM editor Christian May. He couldn't wait to jump in either.
It's definitely a shocker. Even in the long list of shocking encounters with anti-Semitism that Jeremy Corbyn has notched up. There are plenty of classic books in economics and in history that contain elements that are unique to the time in which they were written. And you can praise parts of the analysis while recognising that other parts of it simply don't pass muster today. As Lucy said, Jeremy Corbyn didn't do that. He embraced the analysis in its whole. There are only three possible explanations. He's either thick as mints, or he's an anti-Semite, or he's both.
Or he didn't read the book.
I think if you look at the quality of the foreword, which rather suggests perhaps somebody ghostwrote it for him, he's definitely engaging with the arguments. I'm sure he read the book. It might be the only book he's ever read, and he lapped it up.
What a dickhead. It might be the only book he ever read. Give me a break. That's a bit petulant, a bit childish, a bit silly. Right. It's not prescient today, is it not? I've been doing quite a bit of research on this, not today, but for years. So let me give you a little bit of the benefit of my research. And I read some articles today that I have read before, but I think they're very relevant today. Here's an article from myjewishlearning.com, written by a Jewish editor. Not written this year or last year, but written about 3 or 4 years ago, right? This is myjewishlearning.com. It's a Jewish publication, very widely read. The headline is, "The idea that Jews are good with money is one of the oldest Jewish stereotypes, but it's undeniable that Jews are well represented in finance and business." Let me read a couple of passages. So I'm reading directly from it. If I deviate, I will say straight away that I'm deviating. Okay, I'm not going to editorialise here and selectively cherry-pick bits that suit my argument. Let me read from this article. "Jews did hold prominent financial positions in Europe, which made them ready scapegoats in times of economic crisis. For centuries, so-called court Jews acted as the principal financiers for the European aristocracy's projects. In the 1760s, one of those court Jews, Mayor Amschel Rothschild, established a banking business in Germany that would eventually grow into a vast international conglomerate and yield one of the largest family fortunes in world history. The Rothschild name became synonymous with Jewish financial power, invoked as shorthand for the secretive and outsized power Jews were alleged to wield over the economic fate of the world. Despite his own Jewish ancestry, his parents converted the family to Protestantism when he was a child. Karl Marx, the philosopher who first popularized the idea that capitalism is inherently exploitative, singled out Jews in particular for their role in promoting it. As money lending evolved into institutionalized banking, Jews continued to occupy major positions in the financial world. Across Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries, Jews built a number of influential banks, further feeding anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. With mass Jewish immigration to the US, beginning in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Jews assumed prominent positions in the growing financial centre of New York, establishing Salomon Brothers, Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs and others. They also figured prominently in government financial positions. Since 1987, the chairman of the US Federal Reserve has been a Jew, as have been four of the last eight US Treasury secretaries." Now, this is where I deviate from the article. That's obviously outdated. It's changed. We have had a non-Jewish appointment to the chair of the US Federal Reserve recently, of course, right? So, but anyway, still very relevant. So I go back to the article. "Jews are also significantly overrepresented among the wealthiest Americans. Half of the 10 richest Americans in 2016 were Jewish. This according to Forbes, despite the fact that Jews make up less than 2% of the population." Actor Seth MacFarlane drew criticism for joking at the Academy Awards that it's best to be Jewish if you want to continue to work in Hollywood. MacFarlane's bit was based in inarguable fact. More than 80% of top Hollywood studio chiefs are Jews. According to journalist J.J. Goldberg, himself a Jew, such talk veers into anti-Semitism when one speaks of the Jews controlling movies. The implication being that a corporate entity known as the Jews, acting as an organized group, is conspiring to exert its authority. It's undeniable that Jews are disproportionately among the wealthiest Americans and overrepresented in top positions in the financial world, says Goldberg, but it's anti-Semitic to say that the Jews are. Now, at this point, you need to read Gilad Atzmon and Shlomo Zand and others, particularly Gilad, in his writings about Jewish identity politics and Jewish power and challenging Jewish power and speaking about it. Fantastic stuff, this, from J.J. Goldberg. Jews are disproportionately represented and are overrepresented in top positions in finance and in media, but it's anti-Semitic to say that the Jews are, right, overrepresented. I've talked a lot about that with respect to the UK media. So that's a respected Jewish publication. Let's look at another one, Haaretz. Here's an article from February 2018 in Haaretz, written by Ofri Illini. Let me give you the headline. The headline is, "The link between Jews and money is no longer taboo." After years of focusing on anti-Semitism, more and more historians are daring to deal with a subject long considered untouchable. Let me read a bit of this article. Again, I'm not going to selectively cherry-pick bits. Those articles are Googleable. They're Googleable, and you can read them. Obviously, I'm skimming down them. I'm not reading the entire article. I'm picking out salient bits. Until not long ago, most historians preferred to delve deeply into the history of anti-Semitism or to study the origins of Kabbalah or analyse Jewish philosophy and not dwell, for example, on the story of Jewish trading and banking empires. That subject was largely neglected by Jewish historians themselves. They left it for thinkers who possessed anti-Semitic inclinations. Isn't that interesting? Jewish historians ignored the study of Jewish influence in banking and trading and left it for people that could be described as anti-Semitic. Wow. Actually, Jewish scholars have often sought to emphasize the socialist elements of their culture, a tendency that was consistent with the leftist bent of many Jewish intellectuals in the mid-20th century. But that situation seems to be changing. Not a few contemporary Jewish intellectuals have embraced capitalism as a legitimate economic approach and are not ashamed of it. As such, they are proud to present their co-religionists as pioneers of capitalism. One of the latter group is the historian Jerry Z. Muller. In his 2010 book, Capitalism and the Jews, Muller homes in on the Jewish financiers who established the Deutsche Bank and the Dresdner Bank. A similar approach is taken in The Chosen Few from 2012 by Maristella Botticini and Zevi Eckstein. Their book describes usurious money lending as a Jewish trade, one in which Jews specialised of their own volition in order to exploit their relative advantages over the uneducated general population. Wow. Their book describes usurious money lending money with interest, as a Jewish trade, one in which Jews specialised of their own volition so that they could exploit their relative advantages over the uneducated general population. The Jewish authors maintain that by doing this, the Jews brought prosperity to the countries in which they were active. And the past decade has seen the publication of many studies that promote less sweeping claims but describe global networks of commerce in which Jews played a crucial role throughout the modern era. Taboo no more. Taboo no more for Jewish intellectuals to talk about this subject, but off limits for everybody else. Because to speak of Jewish or Zionist power, whether historic Jewish or Zionist power, or in a modern setting, is to invite a shitstorm down on your head. I've spoken often on this and offered my opinions as to why this is. Former US Assistant Treasury Secretary Paul Craig Roberts has taken it on, the overrepresentation of Jews in finance and the media. Why can't we explore it? Why can't we talk about it without being accused of hatred or anti-Semitism? Why? Let me go back to that amazing statement by J.J. Goldberg again. It's fascinating. Goldberg says, despite the fact that Seth MacFarlane was spot on when he talked about needing to be Jewish if you want to work in Hollywood, Goldberg said, saying such things veers into anti-Semitism when one speaks of the Jews controlling movies. The implication being that a corporate entity known as the Jews, acting as an organised group, is conspiring to exert its authority. It's undeniable that Jews are disproportionately among the wealthiest Americans and overrepresented in top positions in the financial world. But it's anti-Semitic to say that the Jews are. And I think J.J. Goldberg is onto something. And I think Gilad Atzmon has taken this on brilliantly. You see, your classic Jew haters in the independent media, like Ken O'Keefe, the greatest fraudster that ever walked among us, lawyer, robber, thief, should be in prison, will use terms like Jew-tube. Jew-tube, it's the Jews, the Jews, the Jews. J-O-O-S. The Jews, the Jews, the Jews, the Jews. It's the Jews. But it's not the Jews. Because, despite the fact that Jews, or people who identify as Jews, are vastly overrepresented in UK, American media, and in the world of finance, it doesn't change the fact that the vast majority of Jewish people are not, or those who identify as Jews. And they're not sitting around with hooked noses, cackling, with long fingernails, plotting to take over the world. They're not. But there is a financial elite, many of whom identify as Jewish, many of whom have hidden behind their identity, who do manipulate geopolitics and world events like checkers on a checkers board. And they avoid all scrutiny or any manner of scrutiny by the media by hiding behind their stated Jewishness. Zionism, and I've taken this on and talked about that. Why can't we talk about that? Is Jeremy Corbyn getting at that, or is Jeremy Corbyn stupid? Is my great friend Hayden Hewitt right to suspect that, of LiveLeak.com, that Jeremy Corbyn is in fact anti-Semitic, that he is just one of those that just blames it all on the Jews? I don't know. I'd be surprised if that was the case. I don't know. But you can't talk about it. You can't delve into it. You can't mention it. You can't explore it. Jewish influence or Zionist influence in politics and in finance without being called racist, hateful, anti-Semitic, or basically a non-person. And no good can come of that. I do not hate anybody. Certainly not any religious identity group, whether it be a Jewish person or a Muslim person or a Christian. I want to understand where we are, why we are where we are, and how we got here. And I'm open for business. No taboos. You can talk about anything on this particular programme. Got into this last night with Lana Lochteff, who believes that what we're seeing emerging in the world at the moment, this depopulation agenda, comes from a clique of Jews. It doesn't. The people behind it are not religious. They don't care about Judaism or Jewishness or God. They're anti-God and anti-religion. Many of them might have Jewish-sounding surnames, and many of them might claim to be Jewish, and maybe all of them go to the synagogue. But that's a front. Because the geoengineering agenda, the depopulation agenda, the wars of attrition and wars of aggression and all the rest of it, Jews are not exclusively immune to the effects of those agendas. Jews are just as likely to be impositioned, to be hurt, to be, and I mean Jews around the world, or to be damaged, or to be ultimately killed by that agenda. You see where I'm going with this? Fascinating. Those articles that I will put links out to earlier on, where Jewish historians are saying, well, let's really get into Jewish power financially and otherwise, and let's look into how a tiny minority identity group could have so many of its number represented in media and in the world of finance. How did that come to be, and what are the implications of it for the average man on the street who thinks that he's Jewish, goes to the synagogue, and for everybody else? It's 27 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm a little bit behind now, but I'm still going to have loads and loads of time with Sharon Gale. I want to do this before we move on, because it's a big story. Venezuela. President Nicolas Maduro has said that he has stopped an attempted coup by the opposition. Today we continue, Guaido tweeted earlier on today. No, let me do this properly. Let me read this properly. The world's media is predicting mass protests in the coming days after Juan Guaido, the traitor to the Venezuelan people, has been calling for fresh demonstrations. Right. Maduro has come out and said that he's put down this attempted coup. Guaido appeared on television yesterday, surrounded by people in uniform, giving the impression that he was winning the hearts and the minds of the Venezuelan military. But he's not. In a pretty explosive address yesterday or last night, Maduro accused protesters of serious crimes. He said they would not go unpunished, and he said the US was plotting against him. Tucker Carlson's monologue on Fox News was brilliant last night. Do you want to hear a bit of it? I thought it was brilliant. By the way, listen to all of this before you lose your shite. He does say one or two triggering things at the outset, but listen. This is Tucker Carlson on Fox News.
What we do know is that Venezuela's current government has done a poor job of providing for its own people. Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves, yet it remains one of the most impoverished and the most dangerous places on the planet. That is beyond dispute. Everything else is up for debate. Would the overthrow of Maduro make Venezuela a more stable, prosperous country? More to the point, would it be good for the United States? Lots of people claim to know the answer to that, but they don't. They have no idea. If recent history is any guide, nothing will turn out as expected. Few things ever do. But that has not stopped the geniuses in Washington. It has not even slowed them down. This afternoon, on a bipartisan basis, they agreed that the United States ought to jump immediately, face first, into the Venezuela mess.
Yeah, this is unbelievable. Good stuff by Carlson. Then he plays an interview between his Fox News colleague Neil Cavuto and Florida Governor Rick Scott. This defies belief.
Do you think that our presence there would make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. I was down on the Venezuelan border last Wednesday. This is just pure genocide. Maduro is killing his own citizen.
Is it worth, though, however strongly you feel, sir, losing American men and women to do just that?
Neil, here's what's going to happen. We are in the process. If we don't win today, we are going to have Syria in this hemisphere. So we can either make sure something happens now, or we can deal with this for decades to come. If we care about families, if we care about the human race, if we care about our fellow worldwide citizens, then we've got to step up and stop this genocide.
That's incredible. Rick Scott from Florida, nutters, absolute nutters, right? Let's send American troops into Venezuela. Extraordinary. And he wasn't the only one. This is a brilliant bit of summing up by Tucker Carlson.
All right. Just want to make sure that's clear. If you care about families and you care about the human race, if you want to stop genocide, you will send your children to Venezuela to fight right now without even thinking about it, without even weighing the consequences. You'll just do it, assuming you're a good person. Of course, if you don't care about families or the human race, if for some reason you despise human happiness and support genocide, then you'll want to join Satan's team and embrace isolationism, the single most immoral of all worldviews. That's what they're telling you. That's what they're demanding you believe. Message received. We've heard it before. But before the bombers take off, let's just answer a few quick questions, starting with the most obvious. When was the last time we successfully meddled in the political life of another country? Has it ever worked? How are those democracies we set up in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, and Afghanistan tonight? How would Venezuela be different? Please explain and take your time. Next, are we prepared for the refugees a Venezuelan war would inevitably produce? A study by the Brookings Institution found that a collapse of the Venezuelan government could force 8 million people to leave that country. Many of them would come here. Lawmakers in this country proposed giving them temporary protected status. That would let even illegal arrivals live and work here, in effect, permanently, as many have before, with no fear of deportation. Are we prepared for that? Are we prepared to absorb millions of new Venezuelan migrants? All of them great people, no question, but many with little education or skills or English. Finally, how exactly is any of this good for the United States? Our sanctions on Venezuela have already spiked our gas prices. That hurts our struggling middle class more than virtually anything we could do. So what's the point of doing that? So our lawmakers can feel like good people? And if they are indeed good people, why do they seem to care more about Venezuela than they care about this country, the one that they run? They're happy to send our military to South America at the first sign of chaos, but U.S. troops to our own border to stem the tide of 100,000 uninvited arrivals a month? No way, they tell us. That's crazy talk.
Good stuff from Tucker Carlson on Fox News yesterday about Venezuela. Watch it very closely in the coming days. There is a gathering momentum in D.C. more and more congressmen and congresswomen coming to the media, coming to the lectern, to the podium, saying we've got to intervene, we've got to do something, it's genocide in Venezuela and all that crap. Right, it's 22 minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show. Thanks for tuning in. It's live right now on TuneIn Radio, Fab Radio 2, TriggerWarning.tv and my own website. I want to revisit a show that I did last year. I know you know this because I mentioned earlier on, I never had such correspondence to the programme after any other show than this time last year when I invited Sharon Gale on the programme. I'd gotten to know Sharon through connecting to her on Skype. She was very interested in some of the interviews that I'd been doing about forced adoption with Ian Josephs and with the victims of forced adoption. So she got in touch with me. And at the time, I didn't really know who I had in terms of who was speaking to me. I didn't know that Sharon was incredibly well known and that her story was national news and the talk of the country back in 2001, when her story began, of course, because her story certainly hasn't ended. Now, I'm going to summarise this really quickly, and I'll be leaving out bits and bobs, obviously, but I'm going to summarise it. To listen to the entire conversation, it's on YouTube, and it's on Podomatic, it's on iTunes. It's entitled Sharon Gale's Story of Child Death Cover-Up, Government Targeting and Forced Adoption. That's not a sensational headline. That's it. Sharon Gale's Story of Child Death Cover-Up, Government Targeting and Forced Adoption. Listen to it. I'm going to summarise now what happened in 2001. And we'll get Sharon on then. We're going to get an update and then we're going to talk about the subject in general. Now, Sharon and her husband, her ex-husband, Mark, made national news back in 2001, as I said. Then they had a 10-week-old baby girl, Charlotte, and she became very ill very suddenly and was taken to hospital. And she was discharged and readmitted on a number of occasions, discharged and readmitted again. And eventually she was desperately ill and taken to hospital and she died. Right. There's a reason for this, Sharon believes, and I believe she's right. Now, Sharon's husband Mark was accused of killing Charlotte. Her husband then, ex-husband, was accused of killing the child by beating her, by shaking her vigorously. Now, the trial took a couple of years to get to court. It collapsed. There was a retrial and Mark was rightly acquitted. Right? Rightly acquitted. Now, the family's lives were turned upside down, which is a cliche, but they were. Their lives were destroyed. Sharon investigated and wanted answers. If Mark, by the way, the trial collapsing and the trial being thrown out and Mark being acquitted was largely down to the work that Sharon was doing behind the scenes, even though the prosecution wanted to use her as a witness against her ex-husband. But she was working on, you know, getting this thrown out. Again, you've got to hear the original interview. She wanted answers. Who wouldn't? If Mark didn't kill Charlotte, how did she die? Who did kill her? What happened to her? And she was irrepressible in her determination to find out what happened. Now, before her illness, Charlotte had vaccines. There was a health visit and Sharon thought she was taking Charlotte to be weighed. If my memory serves, I think that's what she told me. I did listen to snippets of the conversation today. I think she was bringing Charlotte to be weighed. She was 8 weeks at the time, 8 weeks old, yes. And bringing her to be weighed, because she was a bit poorly and she was a bit weak. And Sharon was told, well, we're going to give her vaccines today. And Sharon was reluctant about the MMR jab particularly. She had misgivings about it. A lot of people did. A lot of people still do. And on the day, Charlotte was given DTaP, meningitis, polio and MMR jabs in the same day. She was 8 weeks old, underweight slightly, not a great eater. 2 days later, she became very, very ill. Very ill. And as I said, she went in, she was discharged, she went in, she was discharged. Each visit, Charlotte's condition was deteriorating. And the final time she was admitted, she became deathly ill, gravely ill. She was rushed to Winchester Hospital. Went to Winchester Hospital. There was a brain scan, CT scan done there. And the doctor who had discharged Charlotte more than once was heard to say, he could be heard saying, excuse my French, fucking hell, someone is going to lose their job. She was then rushed to Great Ormond Street Hospital, famous children's hospital. She was slipping away then, in a very bad way, and doctors there called the police, unknown to Sharon and to her ex-husband Mark. So while they were frantically watching Charlotte's condition deteriorate, the police went to the home and interviewed Sharon's mum and sister, moved them into a hotel and turned the house into a crime scene. Charlotte was still alive at this stage. 2 days later, her life support machine was switched off and Sharon and Mark were arrested. Sharon was released and Mark, the ex-husband, was charged, shaken impact syndrome. So Great Ormond Street Hospital staff acknowledged there wasn't a mark or a bruise on Charlotte before she died, and there was no tenderness when they were handling her. She hadn't been shaken, she hadn't been battered. No death certificate was issued to anybody after Charlotte died. So before there was even an autopsy, the ex-husband Mark was charged, and like I said, this took 3 years to get to court. In court, Alan Anscombe, a pathologist, testified and perjured himself, claimed that he'd carried out an autopsy on Charlotte, the first and only one. He claimed that he had found skull fractures, but he didn't, and reversed himself on that point at trial. There were no fractures. The guy said he'd performed the first autopsy. Keep this in mind. But Sharon Gail, whom will join us in a minute, through incessant, dogged, demanding behaviour, wonderful, searching for answers, learned that, in fact, there was another autopsy, a previous autopsy carried out on Charlotte, and that it didn't come out at trial, and that there was a declaration of cause of death, a shaken baby. Never mentioned at trial, we'll come back to this. No death certificate, despite requests. So 3 years from the time Charlotte died till the case got thrown out. By the way, the case came to court 2 years after Charlotte's death. It collapsed. There was a retrial and then the judge basically threw it out. There was no evidence that Mark had injured or harmed young Charlotte. Sharon had gone online even before this, started digging into shaken baby, discovered the science was flimsy, less than flimsy. She spoke to doctors all over the world, experts who were discrediting shaken baby or shaken impact syndrome and how it was being used in these cases. And she played, as I said, a massive role in the Crown's case collapsing. Did Sharon Gale. Didn't end there, though. Social services declared, you would have thought, you know, the case is thrown out. The judge says no case to answer. This man hasn't injured or murdered his daughter. That's it. Happy days. We all go back to being happy families, right? Maybe we've had a nightmare 3 years. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll head off to Walt Disneyland in Florida for a month and we'll build our lives again. No chance. Social services declared the children were unsafe around her ex-husband and that he couldn't see them or the children. Imagine it. Imagine it. Where's the justice in that? He hadn't done anything. No criminal record ever. No incidences of ever hitting anyone, let alone a child. Judge said it never happened. Social services said, well, we're going to break up your family. You can't be with him with your children. This is all true. It's all documented. Now, I want to say that again. This is not speculation. It's not opinion. I've got all the documentation surrounding this. This is factual stuff here. This is not conjecture. Everything I say to you happened and it is real. Right? No truth or industrial complex journalists are you listening to now with their lies and their exaggeration. This happened to this family. Social service said no. No, you're finished as a family now. Family court destroyed their family. Retaliation. Extreme pressure from social services drove Sharon Gale to Spain with her children near Barcelona. Social services followed her over there. She went to New Zealand. She was followed to New Zealand as well. She came back. Back in 2008, she came back, Sharon and her three children. What did she do then in 2008, Sharon Gale? She went on the offensive again. I love this woman. She'd never had a death certificate for her daughter, so she went to Parliament. She called every Tom, Dick and Harriet. She walked the length of the country harassing and haranguing officials, demanding that a death cert be given to her for her daughter, who died in 2001 in December. So they gave her one in 2011 to shut her up. Jesus, this woman won't go away. What did they give her? They gave her a fraudulent document. I've got it here. Fraudulent! Fraudulent! I know it is. I'm going to explain how. Dated January 2nd, 2002. Charlotte had already been dead for a couple of weeks. Why is it fraudulent? Because it says shaken impact syndrome. By the way, the death certificate gets the mother's name wrong. It's a fraudulent document. It says, cause of death, shaken impact syndrome. Fraudulent? Of course, because it would take months to determine such a cause of death for the child. Months. Months. Not a couple of weeks. Months. So dated January 2002, Sharon is presented in 2011 with a death certificate. And it is bullshit. And it is fraudulent. And by signing it, the registrar, the official who signed it and handed it over to her, was party to a crime. Right? No inquest was ordered, which was unprecedented for a death of this nature. No inquest whatsoever, which I've always believed points to a massive cover-up. So pathology, the autopsy, this guy Anscombe testified that he did it, but he didn't, because in her investigations, Sharon was told by the NHS that a guy called Dr. White carried out the initial autopsy. Not Alan Anscombe, a guy called Dr. White. Anscombe testified that he did, but he didn't. White was the person at the time in Hampshire who would have carried out that autopsy. Did he? Did he refuse to sign off on shaken baby? Was he pressured to do something that he didn't want to do? Whatever the case is, massive discrepancy here, because somebody testified at court that they did the autopsy. It looks very likely that he perjured himself, that the autopsy was carried out by a guy called White. Why was there no mention of it? So a few years ago, after years of this, Sharon moved out of the country for work. And decided not to come back. She's a very smart woman, works in communications, very capable, has worked for some major companies. So she went to Ceylon, she went to Bahrain, met a guy, had a relationship, and had a little girl there. She then went to Turkey for a year and came back from Turkey with her little girl to the UK. Now, she didn't register her daughter here when she came back into the UK, her very young daughter. So in the summer of 2016, Sharon put her name on the electoral roll and problems began immediately. Social services turned up, started asking questions, which ultimately led to her daughter being taken away from her 18 months ago, I think for risk of future emotional harm. And every word of that story that I've just told you there is true. It's documented. I saved the documents sent to me by Sharon Gale. I've got them here. That's the sort of a story you would expect to see on a big screen in a cinema somewhere. You walk out and you say to yourself, Jesus, that could never happen there. They could never conspire to cover up the death of a baby back in 2001. They could never lie and perjure themselves and forge documents. They couldn't do that. And then when the mother refuses to go away, they couldn't follow her around the world and they couldn't kidnap her young daughter by way of retaliation against her 2 years ago. They couldn't do that. That's the stuff of fantasy. That's the stuff of BBC drama, HBO, award-winning stuff. Amazing story, that. But every word of it is true. And it happened to my next guest, Sharon Gale. And when we get her on the line in a minute, we're going to ask her how she's getting on. We have to follow up. What's been happening to you in a year? And we're going to hear about some of the women that she's been meeting in the UK, in the South Coast, in London and elsewhere, going through it. And some of the stories that she's been told and that she's been able to verify are unbelievable in terms of the state coming into people's homes and inventing more and more exotic and fanciful reasons for taking children away from mothers who never harmed nor would harm a hair on their heads. This is the Richie Allen Show. We're live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv. We're on TuneIn Radio and richieallen.co.uk, which you might have said already. Sharon Gale joins me in a minute. I summed up as best as I could the conversation that we had back this time last year. And I know there's a lot more to it than that, but as far as the salient points of it, I think I didn't do too bad. I know, you know, we probably could go 2-3 hours and do it all again, and maybe we will in the future. But
oh, gosh. No, the thing is, I need to apologise to your listeners. Like, 2 odd hours that was. I'm amazed any of them, like, were still there at the end. Two hours we were bagging on there.
It didn't feel like 2 hours. It felt very much shorter than that. I couldn't believe how quickly the time went. And when I said that, I'd never seen that sort of correspondence. That wasn't a lie. You know, I used to do commercial radio and we would speak to people with stories, important stories to tell. And you'd meet people in the street and they would say, you know, I heard an interview this morning on your show with your presenter. I'd never seen that volume of correspondence from people coming in. And I think what really got to people was the documentation that when we were doing it, I was putting on Twitter last year. I was putting the screen grabs out there for people to see. And they could see this stuff. The proof is that what you told me, the story that I synopsized there, was 100% true. And this really hurt people. The idea that any woman, that any person could be put through that. So the obvious question is, it's been a year since you were on. How are you and how are things? I know that you've not been reunited with your daughter. I know I can't name her, so I won't do that. How are you and what's been happening since we spoke last?
I'm just me. I, like, because the situation has gone on so long, I can't actually remember now what the old me used to be. The me that used to always have a sunny disposition who wasn't so serious. I still have elements of that about me, but it's gone on so long, this is like a person I used to know. So, we're just ticking along. I've got to be careful because after the show, of course, there was a bit of blowback from that. I expected it. I would have been surprised if there wasn't. So at the moment, I'm still in court. Thank goodness. My little one, I've managed to stop her being adopted. And there's some other dirty tactics of trying to get her out of the country and such. But I've got to be careful because I'm just...
I know there's very little you can say. I want to acknowledge that. And it's important that our audience understands it. Yeah.
Honestly, Richie, when this journey is over and when the stakes are not so high, I will breach that shut your mouth order from the court in the family court. I will breach it till the cows come home. But because everything is still not even slightly safe for my little un, the shut your mouth order is working a treat, isn't it?
Yeah.
When it's not there, every single piece of paper will be going out. Put me in prison, won't really care. What are they going to do? A year inside? I don't think they'd put me in prison. I'd probably get half of them out.
Yeah.
You know,
do you get to see this much of a pain in the arse?
Outside of prison, I think I could wreak havoc inside. So that doesn't bother me. You know, that doesn't bother me.
You don't worry about that.
At the moment, we're not safe.
So you managed to stop her being permanently adopted. Is there any way you can give us a kind of an overview of how you managed to do that, number one? And number two, do you have visitation with her now?
Well, there's a court order in place to say that at the minimum... I'm to see her for 2 hours once a month. At the moment, this is being breached because I saw her last month and then I've been told that I won't get to see her again until the 29th of June.
Why?
So, yeah, I know. It's fucking horrific.
No, why? Tell me why. What's the reason given for that?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. I've had various things where she is. They're not available. Then I had the contact centre people saying they're not available. But it's a breach. It's a breach of an order. There's a contact order there, and it's a breach of it. So at the moment, I've had to try and be my own solicitor, which is really difficult because I don't know what I'm doing. I understand it, but I don't know.
And why do you need to do that? Explain to our audience. This is massively important. You see, there's a million issues here. Why do you have to act for yourself? Why?
Right. Well, legal aid has been stopped for any child arrangement. Now, if you're in the family court and forced to be in the family court via social services, then you get legal aid. You get your solicitor and your barrister and it's all paid. Be them crap, because there's a boundary of how much you can spend. Unfortunately, we could, well, no, not unfortunately. It was a small win. She hasn't been adopted. So now there's a contact order in place. But in all intents and purposes, we're not in that social services situation anymore. So now it's like anybody else. Say you've got a mum or a dad who's got an obnoxious ex who won't let them see their child. That is for them to take to court. There's no legal aid for that. So that's kind of like the trap that I'm in at the moment. It's kind of like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. This is a better situation than it could have been. Because she's not been adopted.
There is an article in the Law Gazette today, for anybody who wants to read it, about the impact of underfunding for legal aid. And for our American listeners, they'll understand this anyway without me explaining it too deeply. Legal aid is vital for people who can't afford to spend hundreds, even thousands of pounds to
it's
be represented.
It's tens of thousands, of course. I mean, the last barrister that I had was £750 a day. Now, they won't act unless you've got a solicitor who is going to have to read. Like, can you imagine the paperwork to read just in this case? It's weeks' worth. So then you have to pay that. So you can't. The simple fact of it is you can't. You just cannot afford to do that. So you end up doodling along trying to represent yourself. And the thing is, when this does go back to court, of course, I don't have legal aid, but I'm not expecting to see a social worker there representing herself. I'm fully expecting to see a QC, a junior QC, and a solicitor. It's a rigged game. It's like you're going to lose. I know I'm going to lose, but I'm not going to lose quietly.
They can tell you a court order has specifically requested that you get your couple of hours with your daughter every month. And they can say, maybe on any given month, well, the person supposed to supervise that has called in sick or something has gone wrong. Sorry, Sharon. That's just the way it goes.
Well, this is the odd thing because, I mean, I have huge issue with the contact centre, but not the people there. The people there are just normal people and they are telling me they have never known anyone be stuck in a contact centre for as long as this. It's supposed to move on. She should be coming to my house or she should be picked up from the contact centre, dropped off there, slowly, slowly, drip, 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 and then we be normal. I doubt she'll ever live with me, but there should be some level of normality there. So they're like, well, they were expecting me not to be in the contact centre because it's never been known. And it's their availability because I'm supposed to be gone. I'm not supposed to be there anymore.
Yeah.
But I still am, you know.
When you saw her last month, how was she? I'm not trying to make you upset. I'm not. I'll be accused of it, but I'm not. How is she when she sees you?
She's great. There's an odd thing going on at the moment with what the social workers are writing, that they're writing that she no longer calls me mummy. And now I'm tummy mummy. I mean, that's what they tell children that have been adopted and don't see their parents anymore. And they write this through their reports. But I pay for this contact, by the way. So this is another absolute travesty. It's 120 quid.
Each time?
And each time, yeah. But there's people on benefits that are only getting £70 a week. So they're not seeing their children because they can't afford to. Can you imagine that?
Right.
I know. It's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. But getting back, I see this is so, I'm going to go all over the show and I'm going to really try and ground myself here. Because in the reports that the social workers write, I'm now not really mummy anymore. I'm called tummy, according to them. But every single one of my contact reports, which I pay for, they always know. Little un came rushing in, jumped on mum and cries mummy, you know, like full of beans kind of thing. So, but this disassociation between like mother and child is all through these reports, and it simply isn't the case. It simply isn't the case. She's four now. She knows who I am.
They're building a case for permanently adopting her. That's what they want to do. This is how you see it. No matter what happens at the contact, no matter how, you know, well you're doing yourself and, you know, in your own life, they're not gearing or working towards reuniting you with your daughter. They're sole objective seems to be to make the case for adoption. Is that it?
Well, I don't even understand it, because they can't. They can't get her adopted out. They can't. This ship sailed. They lost on that.
They lost that because you won that. So she's in limbo now. You told us they wanted to permanently adopt. You managed to avert that, thank God. So where does that leave the little girl? She's in limbo then, because this is what I wanted to ask you. Where's the oversight from the court? In terms of the court should be pressing social services to say, where are you with respect to reuniting this girl with her mother? But they're not doing that. They can't adopt her, so she's in limbo. So what happens?
We carry on with this shit nest. Sorry.
God, no, it's all right. Not at all. Of you finding £120 a month to visit her for 2 hours. That's the future.
The most recent thing is trying to remove her from the country, which I've not agreed to. So I've had to file papers. And if anyone's in this situation, you can get these papers off of the internet on the government website, and it's a prohibited steps order. So I've just filed that in court, and the breach of the contact. So what happens now, I really don't know.
You have to wait and see.
Like, I don't know. It's social services are no longer apparently in the picture, so I can't go after them. We're just in this sort of like transient nothingness.
Yeah, it's important that you made that distinction. I apologise. I shouldn't have mentioned social services at this point. They're out of the picture. It's with the agency now, or the agency people, right? That's where it is
well,
now.
Yeah, this
the adoption agency.
Yeah, it's just I mean, it's hilarious because social services are no longer in the picture, but they're happy to write stinking reports. And the last time I actually visualised a social worker was about 2.5 months after she was taken. But they're writing reports about me that I've got no ability to change. I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to change, but that's their overriding view. And I've not spoken to one. I've wanted everything in writing, and they don't like that. I've got a complaint in against social services at the moment. I've escalated this complaint off of the back of this fraudulent last document, and nothing, you know. Their response to that was, well, blah, blah wants to call you. And I said, no, we've gone past this now. I want everything in writing. So today I had an email saying, well, as you're not prepared to speak to anyone, tough shit, go to the ombudsman. So I phoned up the ombudsman today, actually wanted to speak to the CEO of the ombudsman. Funny enough, still part of the council, so not really that independent. Was refused his email address or to be able to speak to him. So asked to be put through to his secretary. That was refused. So there's nowhere to go. There will be somewhere to go, but I haven't quite figured it out yet.
You're not going away, though. I want to mention, because there are people joining. I know I'm not, I mean, I'm not on, I don't have access to any stream at the moment, but I know people are joining all the time. So I want to mention Sharon Gale is back on the programme after a year. And this lady made national news back in 2001 when her daughter Charlotte died. Now I'm going to save time here by saying that her daughter was killed as a result of criminal negligence by the health authority and the hospitals that treated her. I have no doubt in my mind. I also have no doubt in my mind that the half a dozen vaccines she was given when she was already ill, when she was brought in to be weighed, had some part to play in this. National headlines, because her ex-husband was charged with shaken infant syndrome. As a result, largely, of the work that Sharon did, this was eventually dismissed by a judge who said that it didn't happen. There was no case to answer. I talked earlier on about fraudulent documents. This is not conjecture. This is all true. It all happened. A death cert that took years and years and years to be presented. It was fraudulent. A mystery about an autopsy. Who performed it? Was it Anscombe? Was it Dr. White, whom it should have been? And what we've had is retaliation against my guest here, Sharon Gale, on a scale that I personally have never heard on a radio show that I've presented. This is where we are. And overseas working, very smart woman, communications, big clients, big companies, has had another daughter. And on return to the UK, for no good reason whatsoever, these people re-enter her life and take her daughter away from her. But you cannot understate that famous court case back in 2003, 2004, when her ex-husband was cleared, when the case was thrown out, no case to answer, all the fraudulent documentation, the obfuscation, the stonewalling of this woman demanding to know, how did my daughter die? Who should have looked after her? Why didn't they look after her? Why was my ex-husband forced to defend himself in court? Why did all of this stuff happen? This is massive, this story. Said earlier on, it's Hollywood stuff. That's not melodrama by me. And here she is today, a year on in, and she's talking about court orders being breached. She should be seeing her daughter for a lousy 2 hours a month. And the agency can say, well, sorry, not this month. You'll have to wait till the middle of June. Nobody wants to know. Legal aid is underfunded for everybody. So now people that don't have any money, right, which is most of us, well, what can we do? So we've got to act for ourselves, not having the legal training needed to go through thousands and thousands of documents. A daughter taken away from a mother for no good reason. And here we are today in 2019 dealing with this. And I want to move it on. Not telling you what to say and what not to say, Sharon, but we talked the other morning about extraordinary cases that you've come across one of them being picked up by the national media, of women who are having their children taken away because they're in arrears with council tax.
Well, I put this up on my Facebook. This lady who got in touch with me because other people's misery I'm getting used to, but this one made me so angry. Like, I'm not an angry person. I really don't do that. But this one, it was just horrific, Richie. Because after that show, people just find you. You know, I had this when murder trial was going on, people in similar situations, and somehow they find you. This lady, only 26, and we were laughing about this because anyone under 30 to me is an embryo, a baby, because I'm fucking old now, you know.
Younger than me.
Screaming not to be, but really the years are chalking up now. Now, this poor lady got behind. She's working full-time, a little girl under the age of 4. She got behind 1 month with her rent, private landlord. He had every right to serve her notice. It wasn't a case of there needs to be dialogue, there needs to be a payment, repayment plan or anything. He was in his legal rights to give her a notice. She had a rolling contract with her lease, so it wasn't like anything untoward there. And in reality, when you looked at the finances of it, this situation wasn't going to resolve itself anyway. So she went at the advice of the Citizens Advice Bureau and family and friends, go to the council, tell them what's happening. You know, they're going to have to find you somewhere to live. You can't be put on the street.
Yeah.
So, like, I'd say like a fool, but if I was in that situation, that's exactly what I would have done as well. So she goes to the council. The council go, oh, well, actually, wait till it all goes to court. It'll probably take 3 odd months for them to chuck you out and come back when you've actually got the eviction notice. So time ticks along. It comes to within 2 weeks of her being evicted. So she goes to the council, gives the notice that she's been given. The bailiffs are going to turn up and they are going to throw her out on the street. There's no question about that. She knew that. Everyone knew that. The housing people are like, right, okay, well, you're still not on the street just yet, so you have to come back the day you're chucked on the street. Well, they didn't say that, but that was the gist. Yeah, that was the long and short of it. You've still got a house whilst you've got a set of keys and you're not on the street, then you have to come back when you are on the street. So that's all fine and great. Not at all. So we've got about 11 days now to the eviction. Tap, tap, tap on the door. Social worker. She thinks they're there to help her. It's been referred from the housing to social services. So she actually, and they say this to her, oh, we've had this referral from the housing department. She lets them in. Well, her house is a fucking shit mess. She's moving. There's boxes everywhere and really they don't know where they're going. So she ends up having to go to a meeting. She thinks they're helping her.
She thinks they're there to look after her and the child, right?
The situation. Yeah. Right. She thinks they're going to find her a home, you know, be it temporary or whatever. She goes along with the whole fucking caboodle of it. She's asked to go to a meeting at the council offices, at the social services offices. She signs a bit of paper. She's not sure what she's signing. But they're there to help. This is her belief, and she believes this. And I've met this lady, and she's so shocked at her own stupidity because chop her in half all the way through, she believed it. So she signs this bit of paper thinking this is just like formalities, doesn't read it. It's like pages and pages long and it's all going to be legal jargon anyway. So I get her on that. Like, I can understand that. You glaze over when you're in a state of trauma. So she signs this bit of paper, goes home to her boxes and not knowing where she's going, only to be informed by the nursery where her child is that she's actually signed an okay for an emergency protection order and her daughter's gone. And is now gone. Is in long-term foster care whilst this care proceedings go through. Can you imagine it, Richie?
Yeah, I can't imagine it, no. No, you sent me the case. She's working, this lady, she's struggling, bills, difficult as a single mother. She gets behind with her rent. The landlord says, look, you're going to have to go. She tells the local authority. They tell her, okay, this happens. When you get evicted, come back to us and we'll find you emergency accommodation. In the meantime, social workers turn up, speak to her. She thinks they're there to help. They ask her to sign some documentation. She's eager to get the mess sorted out and get a council house or a council apartment or something like that. In fact, she's agreeing to a protection order on her own child. The upshot of it is, and you've this is demonstrably provable, this is a true story, that they're saying that you represent a danger to your child because you can't put a roof over her head.
Yeah, what they've
so we'll take
I've seen the court. I'm not allowed to be this lady's Mackenzie's friend. Can you imagine? They now select people who can be Mackenzie's friend, and I don't fit that criteria.
Remind our listeners what a Mackenzie's friend is.
Well, a Mackenzie friend is someone that I need for me in court because I have no legal representation. And yes, this lady does have legal representation, but you're allowed a Mackenzie friend as moral support. You don't have a say in the court as a Mackenzie friend at all, but you're supposed to be allowed to witness what goes on. So if a person who's in trauma or is in, you know, you're going to be in trauma in any court case, they're the open-minded, clear listening person. So if you forget what's happened because you can't take the overwhelmingness of it, you're there to support that person. You're not part of the legal process. So I'm not allowed to be this lady's Mackenzie friend. I'm allowed to sit outside, which is great because she's inside, you know. It's like, oh, God.
What about the enormity of this? Because, again, I've got to say this. It's very important. I can vouch for the veracity of this. This is a true story. Every word of it. What you heard there is true. A woman who's fallen behind with her financial affairs, not a layabout, not a drug addict, not an abusive mother, a woman who works but can't quite make ends meet, was in private rented accommodation in the private sector, renting from a landlord, gets into trouble, can't afford it and needs a place to stay, has had her child taken away. I mean, the enormity of that. There will be people listening to it and they will think that's not happening. That couldn't happen. This is Britain in 2019. We help people like that. People will say, I'm fed up of finding that unmarried mothers are getting access to council houses all over the place. This has got to be bullshit, people will scream. They will cry.
Well, the premise of what I've seen, and obviously I've not been in the court proceedings, but I've certainly seen the documents, and this is filthy. Absolutely about as filthy as it comes. What they've actually they've done a double whammy on this poor lady, because they've put the child at future risk of physical abuse and future risk of emotional abuse.
Why? Because the woman is broke and she's got no house. Is that it?
No, the physical abuse is the same as the emotional abuse, because you might be on the street and anything can happen. And you might be in emergency accommodation over and over again.
And you've seen this document, Sharon. You've seen this. I know you've seen this. How could a judge take this and not punch the social workers in the face? Are you really coming to me, into my court, asking me to separate a mother from her daughter because she's broke, might end up on the streets and might get annoyed and might slap her child in the face? Are you kidding me?
They're not even accusing Richard.
No, I know they're not. I know they're not.
Accusing her. They're not even putting that accusation there. What they're saying is that the risk of physical abuse could be from another homeless person, an unknown homeless person who may interfere, hurt, whatever, her child.
So becoming financially unstable is tantamount to child abuse, potentially. That's yep. it, isn't it? In a nutshell, you've got yep. no money, love. That's your fault. How dare you have no money? Because by having no money, you might end up on the curb, and there are some unsavoury people there who might take advantage of your daughter or might physically abuse her. You lousy bastard, so we're taking your child away.
And the potential emotional abuse here comes exactly from the same made up scenario of the unknown homeless person that this little girl may witness her mother being abused on the street by random passers-by, by a random homeless person. Situations that haven't happened, because at this stage the woman wasn't on the street. It's disgusting.
This lady, you've befriended this lady, you sent me all the information on this, and it's true. I've got to say this again, this is true. What's her living situation right now?
She's sofa surfing.
She's going to mates' places and stuff like that.
There's another story that I know of, and I say story, and it's not a bloody story. This is people's lives. Another person that came to me, she had her children removed, and ended up being homeless because her children were removed. Again, potential risk of emotional abuse. Her children were removed. Social services then let the council know that her children have been removed. She's on the streets now because they won't pay any benefits for that home. So obviously she was a family of five, including herself. Now she's a person of one. She'd been in that house 12 years. They chucked her out. She's on the street. In all intents and purposes, she has no address, you know.
And the media used to cover this. We talked about this the other day. Christopher Booker used to write about it. Sue Reid used to write about it. But they don't anymore. Christopher's retired. And Sue Reid, who I think is a really, really worthwhile woman and a very good journalist, she's got mouths to feed. And I suppose the editor of the Daily Mail says, sorry, enough of these stories, Sue. Enough of these forced adoption stories. How many of these are we going to run? And she can't do anything. I imagine she'd love to be covering this stuff, but they can't do it. And of course, there are gagging orders against naming anybody involved. This is a fascist country we're living in.
Yeah, it's a totalitarian regime, isn't it?
Yeah, we can take your children based on some imagined scenario.
And you can't say a fucking thing about it.
You can't speak about it.
Or we're going to put you in prison.
And it is worth millions and millions of pounds a year to the adoption agencies and to the parents who foster. In fact, it's £1 billion a year industry. And just in case we forget to mention this, 20,000 children a year go missing, never to be found again in this country, whom were in foster care or were in permanent adoption. Now, before you think this is a conspiracy theory, let me point out again, this is not a truth or industrial complex programme. This is a fact. 20,000 children a year vanish into thin air who've been taken into this system. And we're not saying that there aren't children who need to be taken. I should have been taken out of my family situation when I was a young boy. The things that were done to me. But that's not the majority. That's not the rule. I'm right, Sharon. That's not the rule. That's the exception. The rule seems to be some woman who's down on her luck or used to have a drug problem years ago or had a bit of depression at one time in her life or whatever. We better take that child.
Oh, my God, Richie, don't even get me on this. Another person that I know of. These are not my friends, you know. They're not my friends. They're people that have come across me, you know, and I can't I can't not help if you can help. And actually, I can't help, but I can listen. And, you know, you're given a platform that at least I can speak on their behalf. Another lady, excuse me, sorry. Hay fever time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, tell me about it.
Another lady had her children removed because actually she was in care years and years and years ago. So potentially, according to them, if you've been in care, you're going to be a fucking shit mum. And they'll crawl all over this. Well, she had, the court had actually said she had an inability to change. Well, she was quite angry at the way she'd been brought up. So, yeah, I doubt she will ever change. So this didn't really work so well because actually she'd been a great mum. The kids were in school, no sick time that would cause any trouble. They weren't grubby, nothing. School reports were fine. Social services stick their beaks in. She ends up going to her doctor's. Because she's got anxiety and depression and God knows what else, which of course she would have.
Why wouldn't you?
I can't imagine anyone comes out of this situation without PTSD at the very least. So she ends up going on some drug called citalopram or something like that, I don't really know, which is for anxiety and depression. So the future risk of emotional abuse has now morphed into the fact that she's a manic depressive. Them kids won't be coming back. And that's because she went to her doctor for some help. Now she's a mental case. You know, it's like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Let me ask you a question. Sharon Gale is our guest, and she'll be with me for another 15 or so minutes. And I've got to mention again, go to youtube.com or go to Podomatic or iTunes and Google Sharon Gale's story of child death cover-up. Just put that in and listen to the story last year. 2 hours will go by in the blink of an eye if you've never heard it. Sharon was in national media spotlight for years in the early 2000s. Her daughter was wrongfully killed, either by the cocktail of shit that was injected into her arm when she was tiny, when she was brought for a weight check, or by gross negligence of the hospital, of the paediatricians who were supposed to look after her, when they kept discharging her when she was getting more and more and more and more ill. They tried to fit her ex-husband Mark up for it. This is all documented, all proved. To try to say that he was a child murderer, that he killed his own child, that he was abusive. He wasn't. It was bullshit. It was thrown out quite rightly after two trials, the first one collapsed. Sharon had a lot to do with that. You see, we're dealing with and I'm not kissing her arse here. I mean this. This is an incredibly bright woman, hugely successful in her own field, and articulate, and tough, and brilliant at research. Brilliant researcher. Figured this out, what was really going on. The lies, the defrauding of documents, the withholding of information in court about the autopsy, the pathologist. Unbelievable stuff. And for having the temerity to embarrass the system, they came after her. And that's why we're talking again after a year. This is not conjecture. I'm sick of saying this. This is true. All the documents were published by Sharon Gale, and I put them on the internet last year after she gave them to me. All of them. MPs were bewildered. The House of Parliament was bewildered, asking questions on her behalf. They did. They read the documents. They did ask questions, but only once. Then they went away when they didn't get any answers. Now they've come after this lady and separated her from her daughter, whom she never laid a hand on, after she came back to the country from Bahrain. This is what they're doing to people. And let me ask you this. Do you think that anybody listening to this today gives a shit, to be honest? I wonder.
God, that's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think they do. I'm just going to give you an example of what is going on in this country. I know you don't have Facebook anymore. I don't really use Facebook other than to ask people stuff. So I was on a number of groups in Facebook, and I didn't go into Charlotte's details or my own story at all. I put on a couple of these groups, which were like budgeting groups, you know, how can you make a dinner a week for like 20 quid or whatever. And I'd heard a case of a lady who'd been referred to social services because she'd used a food bank 3 times in 2 months. And I was like, this can't be true. Yeah. Are people now putting themselves and their children at risk through fear of social services? So I put this up on a number of sites. And honestly, Richie, considering no one knew who the fuck I was, or what my point was, because I just wanted to know if this was a real concern for people bringing up their children when they have no money. And I put this out there and I said, please PM me. I won't make any name references. I'm doing an interview within a media thing. Is this actually real? My God, my other box on your messages was full of people either saying, yes, they'd had social services around because they'd used the food bank, or that they were too scared to go to a food bank because of that very reason. I mean, so, yeah, people do care because
this
it's
affecting
everyone. This is unfucking
believable, this. How are social services finding out who is going to food banks? But I don't understand. Thanks be to Christ, we get by, my partner and myself. You know, we're, like I suppose everybody else who works, we're probably 2 or 3 months away from the curb if we didn't have income for 3 months. But we're all right, and we've never had to do that, thank God.
What we need to actually talk about here, Richie, is the fact that universal credits came in for these low-income families, whether they are working or not working. And within that swap over into universal credit is a 5-6 week wait where you get fuck all.
You get nothing. Can I just explain this very quickly? People used to get various benefits, housing allowance benefit, job seeking allowance benefit, fuel allowance, different benefits, and they used to be stretched out over a monthly period. That was handy for people. The vast majority of people on benefits are deserving of them. They're decent. They really need the help. They're not scroungers.
And they're working.
This is the thing. So many of them are working.
The majority of people are working.
Well said. Well said. They're working. But it's not enough to get by. This is important. They rolled all this into one payment. There was a 6 week delay then before people got paid, and it's plunged people into absolute despair. Here's the question. When you go to a food bank, have any of these people told you, do you need to give some ID when you go to a food bank? Do you need to explain who you are? How does it work?
What I found out was, because thank goodness I've never been in that position. And it could happen to me next week or the week after. You know, no one knows what's around the corner. So there's no snobbery here, because we could all be in the same boat. And it's a fucking sinking ship of shit. What happens is, to actually be referred to a food bank, you have to either be referred by a social worker. Brilliant. Your GP or someone at the job centre. They have to refer you and give you this certificate, whatever it is, this piece of paper.
So Jesus
that then
Christ.
You go
I didn't know
to
this.
That food bank, and so you have to be referred there. You know, it's not like you just stroll up there. This is me. This is my address. Here's my council tax bill. Here's my passport. No, you can't do that. You have to be referred by a government body, the same government body that's then going to use this against you.
My God, we've just had a tweet confirming what... Well, look, I didn't need a tweet to confirm it. I know that you have done the research. Somebody tweeting under the name Shafted, appropriately, tweets, Richie, you have to fill in a form every time you go to a food bank. Every time I've had to use my local one, I've had to fill in a form. Well, I see, again, talk about being educated, I had no idea. So if we fell into a bad state, we, as you said there, would have to inform the local authority informed the doctor to get the consent then to go to the food bank. This is how they know, and they're now using this against people in protection orders.
To steal their children.
To steal their children.
And it is stealing. It's stealing lives. You know, it's physically stealing lives.
Because the child is a commodity.
So now we've got a number of women, and I wouldn't even want to hazard a guess, not just women, men too. That's me. Like, there's plenty of single dads out there doing a sterling job. But now we've got a group of people who have been switched onto universal credit, are in a bit of a shit mess, but are now too scared to go to the food bank because their mate
so they'll go hungry.
Want to be under that radar. So this is actually a child protection issue, and a real child protection issue, because people are now too scared to go to the very place that offers them protection. What the fuck is that all about?
I have no idea. Well, I do have an idea. You know, people think it's about money. Ian Josephs believes it's about money. Nobody's done more research on it than him. The depth of research on forced-adoption.com is unbelievable. I recommend anybody encountering this for the first time, go to forced-adoption.com.
His underlying advice is correct.
Get out.
Don't engage with them.
Yeah, or get out.
Just don't engage with them whatsoever. If you can afford to, leave the country. You know, like, I was a fool to have come back here. You know, and now I'm stuck here. I don't want to be here. I want to leave this country. I can go and earn a living anywhere in the world. But I'm held hostage, like my daughter's held hostage. As long as she's here, I have to be here. It's disgusting.
I said to you last week, and I meant it, you know. The worst part of speaking to you, and the worst part of it last year was, and this is a male thing, and it also sounds very selfish, you know, it sounds like that, you know, you're trying to make this somehow about you. It's not about me. You know, this doesn't affect me personally, directly, because I haven't experienced it. I don't have any children. It hasn't happened to any friends of mine. It affects me the way it affects most people that are decent. It's hurtful to hear an articulate, intelligent, qualified, you know, good-looking woman, got it all going for you, never done anything to anybody, to hear somebody like you describing it, it's hurtful to me. What kills me is that there's nothing that we as the media can do about it. I remember years ago working in commercial radio, told you this the other morning, Sharon. I remember listening to Gerry Ryan, rest in peace, fantastic Irish radio presenter. And people would go to him with their problems when there was nobody else to go to, when the council wouldn't do anything for you, when nobody cared. You'd ring Gerry, and 400,000 people in Ireland would hear you speak with Gerry, and stuff could be done. And when I did commercial radio on a successful radio station with a massive listenership in Munster, occasionally people would ring up, not like with anything like with stories and experiences like yours, but they were getting fucked over somehow. And we could do something, because we had a little bit of clout. You know, we could ring somebody up and threaten them, we'll keep broadcasting this every day unless you look after that woman. In 2019, because of what's happened to the media, and because the independent media, we don't get a fraction, we don't get a grain of sand, you know, in terms of a whole beach. We don't get a grain of sand in terms of listeners as they do. We can do fuck all, only talk about this. It's real, it's happening. Poverty is having people, is having children removed from families. Retaliation, in your case, is having your daughter taken away from you. And what the fuck can we do about it? Nothing, only talk about it. What can we do in the 5 minutes we have left? What can we do, Sharon?
I really, you know, I don't know. Because here I am in the thick of it, with people coming to me. And what can you do? Well, I haven't found anything that I can do. And I've tried, you know. There's nothing I haven't tried. And I think about it constantly. Like, there must be a way. But I don't think there is. Until, like, everybody just decide, and we spoke about this, didn't we, the other morning, the only way to do this is if everyone went on strike for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Don't buy anything, don't watch the telly, don't put petrol in your car, like, just conk the system out for 2 weeks.
With regard to
civil disobedience, you get change, because unless something hurts the pocket of the Treasury, they don't give a shit.
Do you know what, Sharon? 100% you're right. Here's something, and I'm not trying to make problems. I'm going to sound like a real moron now for being a downer. But until I spoke with Emma Ibbotson on this programme 4 years ago, I would have been of the opinion, oh, that girl over there had her child taken away, did she? She must have done something. She must deserve it. And that's what you've got with people. Because I still get the occasional email. Oh, Richie, you're a big bleeding heart liberal. You big softy. Anything for the ratings. Pretending that you've got sympathy for these women. You know, Richie, that it's a line of bullshit. When people have their children taken away, there must be a good bloody reason. That's what people think.
I get it. I get what you're saying, because when I put these posts out on these groups about this universal credit and food bank issue that I'd been told about and was trying to clarify this, lots of people were writing on these forums about how shit social services were.
Yeah.
And like, I'm trying not to go, yes, they are shit, and just sort of suck it up, buttercup kind of thing. And then there's the odd one, isn't there? There's the odd one. Well, I was a social worker, and rah, 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 this doesn't happen. There has to be an underlying issue. And even if this is the thing with me, even if there is or was an underlying issue, because the law has changed that now care proceedings have to conclude in 26 weeks. So you're talking 8 weeks if that gets gobbled up for court dates, even trying to facilitate court dates, then another few weeks gets gobbled up by the fact that social services have to meet everyone involved, write reports, so there's a few more weeks. So really, there isn't the time scale. Even if someone had a drug problem or a drink problem in the past or mental health issues, whatever it is, financial issues, by the time you're in court and these 26 weeks are up, the court will go, there's no demonstrable evidence here that this person has the ability to change. How the fuck can they in that time scale? Because you're talking 10 weeks if you're lucky.
Do me a favour, will you? Come back anytime you want and talk to us. And if there are people who want to come on and if they feel they can do it in a way that won't harm them or their case and they want access, even though I'm not going to... I've never lied to anybody. Before we spoke last year, I told you, listen, we might have a few thousand people listening in England. We might have a few thousand in Ireland, a few thousand in America. It looks great on paper, but ultimately... what can we do? I said this to you. I never tell lies to anybody about, oh yeah, we're amazing and we can do this. If they want to come on, I don't know if it's only just to let people know that it's happening, there'll always be time on this programme for it. I know there are people who can't listen to it. I've had tweets from people tonight saying, I love this woman. This woman is amazing, but my heart is broken. I can't listen to this. And they
see,
say
and this is the worst thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because my story is horrific, but I live it, so it kind of doesn't shock me. And I'm getting to the stage where every other person that comes to me, I'm getting so unemotional about this because it just happens all the time. And I don't want to be that person that comes across like I don't see every single one of these parents as families broken, lives broken. And it's not just you take a child away from one parent or two parents. That's not two people that are affected. That's three people at the very beginning, the child and the parents. But it's not. It's the friends. It's the family. It's the decimation of communities. Because then there's the, well, what did they do? Speaking in whispers, people feel isolated, they end up drinking too much, they end up on drugs. Like it's a corrosion of society. But I don't want people to be upset by it, like emotionally upset by it. I want them to be angry about it because it's happening and our taxpaying money is going towards funding this shit. But not to be distressed, you know? It's a distressing situation, but not to shut down because it's well, actually, I imagine that anyone listening to this who doesn't think I'm full of shit can look at themselves and think, fuck, this could happen to me. And yeah, it really could. It could happen to anyone. But that's not a reason to get upset. It's a reason to be, I don't know, powerful about it. Because knowledge is power, and it always has been.
See, what happened to you is very much in two or three parts. And the worst thing for me, it's not the worst thing. Your daughter being taken away from you is heinous. And if there is a hell, and I don't believe in God, if there is one, the people involved,
I think
in
we're
it,
in it.
We might be in it. This might be it.
I
this
swear is, to God, this I is think purgatory should be or a hell, Jehovah yeah. Witness because they think we're in hell, and I'm yeah. like kind of going along that line.
Do you know the point I was going to make was, I'll give you the last word then before we wrap it up. The point I was going to make was, there's so much to what happened to you. And for me, heinous as what's happened recently is, I can't get my head around why you've got the hardest evidence I've ever seen in my life. I swear, if there is a God, I swear on all that's sacred. I've been doing this for years as a producer, way back in the day, with great presenters. Like, you'd have been an amazing producer. You're such a fantastic researcher, and you're dogged. I've never in my life seen such a clear-cut case of state corruption and cover-up, medical cover-up of what happened to your daughter, Charlotte. And what I can't get my head around, why human rights organisations or human rights lawyers haven't put their arm around you and said, right, Sharon, we're going to stay with this until the day that we can get this exposed across a panorama show on the BBC, across Channel 4. Your child was killed either because she was vaccinated to death or because of gross negligence, and they tried to destroy your family in a bid to cover it up. I've never seen such clear-cut evidence. There's no two sides to this. And that's what stays with me as much as what happened to your daughter 18 months ago. You know what I'm saying? I can't believe that nobody has picked it up. You know,
this is the thing, Richie. I honestly believe in my heart that if I could find someone to help me with Charlotte's case, I don't want money from it. We spoke about this the other day.
Yeah.
It'd be disgusting. You know, it would, to me, it would be abhorrent. It's not about suing people. It's about accountability. Now, I know in my heart that if someone would take my case, come with me to the police station, because I'd be too scared to go on my own because I'd probably get fucking arrested for something I haven't done. If someone would come to the police station with my documents and say this is monumental fraud, there needs to be a prosecution. But who's going to do that? Because the documents I've got are from the fucking Home Office. They are the justice system.
Yeah.
So where to go? You know?
Yeah.
European Court of Human Rights? Ugh. I don't know how to do that. You know? I don't know how to do that. I probably do have a case because, my goodness, I've tried every avenue in the UK. I can prove that. Which is all you need to do is prove that you've tried every establishment in your own country to go to the European Court of Human Rights. But I don't know how to do it.
I've got a file here. It's going to say this for my listeners. I've got a file here entitled Sharon. And when Sharon got back in touch with me, which is a failing of mine, I should have been in touch with Sharon. I've apologised to her for that. It's not that I forget anybody who comes on this programme. But my only excuse is I'm the chief cook and bottle washer here. But Sharon got back in touch with me, and I went to the file, you know, I've got a file with about 15 documents there, which prove, and as Sharon said, they're Home Office documents, which prove one of the most heinous abuses of human rights and perversions of justice that you could ever wish to see in your life. Right there. You know, it should be a matter of weeks before the state apologises to Sharon Gale and to her ex-husband and says, we fucked up. We're responsible for the death of your daughter. No apology is going to bring her back. No amount of compensation is going to pay for the retaliation and the breaking up of your family and the harassment. But look, we did it. We're sorry for what it's worth, and we're going to make sure it doesn't happen again. You'd give your right arm for that, wouldn't you?
Some accountability.
Yeah.
I don't want money. Yeah. I just want this to stop for me. I'm 44 now. I'm still single. On me Jack Jones kind of thing. Because who would want to take on me and all this bullshit? So until I can resolve this, life is in limbo. And the resolution of this sits with Charlotte. Because none of the rest of it, the blowback, none of it would have happened unless that situation hadn't occurred. If had that situation not occurred, none of this would have happened to me or my family. None of it. But I just want it to stop. I don't even care if anyone's sorry, because I probably wouldn't believe it if it was said, if someone was forced to say they were sorry after this length of time. I would probably see that as a little bit of an insult, too little too late. But there must be someone out there that can actually stop this, because I can't, you know? I can't stop this for me. I can't stop this for anyone else. And I wish I could.
Everything you sent to me last year, I might have mentioned this towards the end of the programme last year, but everything you sent to me, I did what any half-baked producer should do. I basically attached it to an email and sent it to all the parties and to the party leaders and to the chairman and chairpersons of the political parties in this country. I swear on that. I've still got the emails that I sent. They're still in my sent box. I never got a response. Not one.
No, nor do I anymore. it's election time here. Brilliant. Every moron's been knocking on my door. Apart from the Conservatives, because I don't live in the richest of areas in Portsmouth, and apparently the police had to be called to get rid of the Conservative door knockers. So I've had Lib Dem at my door, I've had UKIP at my door, I've had the Green Party at my door, and I've had Labour at my door, no Conservatives, because they're too scared to come here, which says everything, doesn't it, when you have to have the police safely escort you away from an area because you're hated so much. But none of these knob jockeys can do anything. They can't.
The point you're making is, even if you got a genuinely sympathetic would-be MP or would-be local councillor and somebody who genuinely meant that they were shocked by your story, there's nothing they can do, because presumably they'll get the same response I got last year, which will be none, or they'll be told, listen, shut up and mind your own business.
Well, exactly what I said on the last programme when I was living just outside of Winchester. We had Mark Outon as the MP. And while that trial was going on, oh, my God, he was kissing my backside. Oh, he's so sorry, he's so sorry. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. He didn't do any of it. But then when there was the leadership thing, when I think it was it Charles Kennedy? Was Lib Dem then? He died. He then went to do a run to be the head of the party. And when I went to him and I'm like, right, fair game, what are you going to do? He said to me, I'm really sorry, I've banded this around my colleagues, meaning Parliament, and they've said it's career limiting. So no one can touch this case if they're political, because it's career limiting. And that's the fact of it. I mean, I'm quite glad that karma does sort of come round, because poor old Mark Outon, I mean, West Ham football kits and malarkey.
And all of that jazz, yeah.
Look, it couldn't happen to a nicer chap in my book, but hey, I'm not a fan of people being hounded by the Red Tops. But
no,
there was a little irony in there that my voyeuristic way.
Yeah, it's karmic.
Liked.
I think it's karmic. Thanks for coming back on and updating us on your situation with your daughter, and that's still going through the courts. And I know you'll keep us updated on that. And I know that you'll come back sometime this year. You'll come back on the program and spend more time with us. And thanks for highlighting those cases and for sending me the information to support those cases that you highlighted. Those ladies, the lady whose rent arrears has resulted in her losing her child, and the food bank story, which is massive. I'm going to I'm not going to chop up our conversation. I've got a little bit of editing to do because we went off air briefly, and I'll get this stuff on Podomatic and on YouTube soon. And I just urge people who have been listening to it live, do your best to share it around, because I think one of the most important things you said to me last year and today is the cautionary tale aspect of this is valuable. Even if I can't, you know, do anything through the programme to wake, you know, politicians up to it, which I can't, at least if people listening to this can listen and just box a bit clever. I'm not saying that Sharon Gale didn't box clever. She did. She did everything she could for justice for her daughter, Charlotte. And the blowback has been what we've spoken about tonight. The result has been the kidnapping of her young daughter, who isn't 5 yet. But you got to listen to stories like Sharon's, and you've got to box clever. So as a cautionary tale, at the very least, this is something that you need to expose other people to this interview and that. Look, I hope you know. I think you're unbelievable. You know, I think most people would have just pissed off years ago and given up on it. The fact that you're still there, sleeves rolled up, you know, and battling for your daughter and for other people, I don't know what to say to you. You know, I'm amazed by you. I don't have that sort of constitution. I'm not that courageous. I wouldn't do it. I think I'd just give up. I would leave and go away. And you're still there, and I just think you're amazing. And that's my final word on it.
This is the thing, isn't it? I don't think you would. And I don't think lots of people would give up, because I think in all of us is that need to have things put right when they're wrong. And my God, when this all started with me, I wasn't even 30. I would never have thought that I would have been this resilient. But we all are. And what this secret court does, it puts people in fear. It isolates them, so they're too scared to say because of judgment. And actually, there is no judgment. And every time you and I do a thing like this, even if 10 people hear it and they're not isolated, because there's the other thing, and I know we're running over here, so I'll say it very quickly, that there are people committing suicide over this.
Inevitably, yeah.
And because they're isolated, because they think everyone believes the shit that's been told about them. And every time you and I do something like this, or you do with other guests, it opens it up. It's not a dirty secret. But for many people, they feel like it's a dirty secret. And it really isn't. It's a secret because the courts make it this way. But you as an individual, whether you fucked up in the past or not, no one deserves this. Nobody deserves this. They need to be nurtured, helped, and supported, not vilified and isolated. So if nothing else, if someone listens to this and they're like, okay, I'm not on my own, I'll get in touch with Sharon Gale. Well, go for it. Get in touch with me. I can't cure it, but I do understand it.
We can talk, you know? Yeah.
What else can you do?
Yeah, just to be able to talk to somebody who understands it. You know, a woman got in touch with me last year after we spoke, and her name is Eileen, and she lives in Belfast. This is, it's just come back to me. And she said that her 3-year-old daughter died in an accident back in the early 1990s. And she said she still struggles with it, which, again, I can't say I understand, but, yeah, of course, it's understandable. Who would get over it? because it's such a horrible thing, an accident, wrong.
And she said, "We don't bury our children. That's not how it's supposed to be, is it?"
Correct. And she said she feels that her horrible experience of coming to terms with the death of a child, she felt it pales into insignificance compared to having a child taken away wrongfully and wondering all the time, how is the child feeling? And then she said to me, she said, "Of course, Sharon Gale has experienced everything. Coming to terms with the death of Charlotte, wrongful death, and then coming to terms with, you know, the family breakup forced by the family courts, and then coming to terms with your young daughter being taken away 2 years ago." She said, yeah, she said, I think losing a child in an accident is not as bad as what people are going through when the children have been taken for no reason and they're lying awake at nights wondering, how is she getting on? How is he getting on? And are they thinking of me? Have they enough to eat? When she said that, I lost it in the email. Have they enough to eat, you know?
She's right in so many ways with that, Richie, because I can remember when the court case was going on, people were reaching out to me who were actually not in criminal proceedings but in family court proceedings with this shaken baby whatever it was called at that stage, fabricated induced illness, FII or something like that, that people were being accused of. Because I'd been a bit trappy, people were finding us. They were finding us through the company. The boardroom turned into like a counselling arena for a lot of time. And I can remember back then thinking, oh, my God, I cannot imagine what it's like to know that somebody else has your child. Because I was grieving, but no one had my child. I knew where her grave was. No one had her. And then you end up, like, all these years on. And I don't know what's worse. I don't know what's worse. Because life is life. So, of course, to be alive is so much better than to have your daughter in a cemetery. But on a grieving process, when your child is taken, there's no grieving process. It's just continuous, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I think I do, yeah.
Yeah, it's just there can't be closure to that. And for these people that have lost their children through adoption, the only time that their grieving process will finish is when they die. And some people are choosing this over living with it. And I mean, that's horrific. What civilized society does this?
I suppose it's our job as listeners. You know, we've had the privilege to listen to you. Let us in on what happened to you and share it with us. It's our job to make more people aware of it. People have to know it's going on. It's only when people know that it's going on, because I think people are fundamentally decent. That's why I asked earlier on, do you think people give a shit? I wasn't being negative. I wasn't suggesting that people don't give a shit. I was getting at that they just don't know. I think if enough people know, then you'd see the sort of outrage that could bring about some sort of change. We need to shine a light on it, really, is what we need
but
to do.
But this is the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think underlying in your belly, you do know. Because if I was to take five people off the street who don't know me and I don't know them, and I said, what's your views on social services? I would pretty much say 4 out of 5, it would be negative, and they don't know why it's negative. I mean, who wants that as a job? Nobody, apart from narcissists and bullies. No one wants that as a job. And if you say, oh, yeah, well, what do you think about social services? Everybody is like, don't mention the war. So we do know in our bellies, whether we've been touched by it or not, there is a stigma attached to social services, and quite rightly so. They're awful.
Some of them are all right, though. That's the thing. They're not all bad.
No, this is the thing. Oh, God. And I promised when I put this out on my asking questions, I had a couple of social workers actually get in touch with me, and they were pointing out to me how difficult that job is. Most of them have left because it was too difficult, and the bureaucracy within the system made them feel like they weren't helping anymore. They were part of a system, and the help element had been lost along the way. And I had someone say to me, what's the point of you doing this? Because you're biased. And I was like, I'm not biased. I'm biased by my own experience. But I'm not on universal credits. I'm not committing suicide. I haven't had my child taken because I'm a month behind with the rent. How's that biased? It's factual.
Come back again, will you? Let's chat again when there's more news about your own case. I've just got to say before we go, I'm going to wrap it up and go to YouTube and look for Sharon Gale's story of child death cover-up. The entire story is there in detail. What happened to Charlotte? What happened to the family? Thanks for coming on tonight to update us on that. And again, thanks for sharing those other stories. And like I said, I look forward, if that's the way of putting it, if that's the right way to put it, to speaking to you. I'll be speaking to you in the interim period, of course, anyway. But come back on again and talk about it, because as long as this is going on, I'm going to talk about it, Sharon. Thanks again for coming on. I'll give you the final word, and then we'll wrap it up, and I'll get it on online as quick as I can.
Honestly, I think I've probably jabbered on too much.
Not at all. If you did, I would have closed it down. I'm a hard bastard, me. No, I would have done. I know I would have said, look, you know, we're going around. We weren't going around in circles. There was a lot to say there, and it's important. No, you weren't jabbering on.
It's too complex, but yeah. Final words, it's not all bad out there. So let's not leave on a negative note. There's always beautiful things out there. The sun's shining and the birds are singing. And thank you, Richie.
Thank you, Sharon. Thanks for coming back on. And we'll chat again real soon. Well, I'll be in touch with Sharon before, obviously, she comes back on again. We're in touch, of course. That was Sharon Gale, who I think is the best of us. I really do believe that. Not to go away. I said it earlier on about Hollywood scripts and stuff. When you watch films about cover-ups and whistleblowers, generally, at the end, there's some justice, isn't there? At the end, somebody goes against the grain. Some journalist says, no, fuck it, no, I'm going to write about it. Or some news anchor says, no, fuck it, I'm going to speak about this on live television. People have to know this stuff. It's depressing for people. I will get emails tomorrow from people saying they were crying and it's so bad I switched off, Richie. I understand that. And I don't blame anybody for getting so upset by it, by the reality of it, that they say, I can't listen. It's not selfish. It isn't. Don't beat yourself up. Don't beat yourself up for every email I had last year. And when I had Emma Ibbitson on, whose child was taken because she was featured in a road safety ad. It's no joke, by the way. You know, Sharon said tonight they're taking children because the mother can't feed them. They're taking children because the mother can't pay the rent. It's going on. People go to food banks. You've got to get a form signed off by a local authority or a doctor. You've got to get a form before they'll give you a can of beans and a bit of pasta. Fucking wonderful, right? And because you've had to do that through official channels, now they're knocking on your door to see, well, I wonder, should we take your child away? Why? Well, you can't provide for it. We know they're putting people in prison because they can't pay their council tax. We know this. I've talked about this on the programme. Brilliant bit of journalism by a woman at The Guardian to expose this. I invited her on the programme, not heard back from her. Fair enough. I understand why mainstream journalists don't want to come on this programme. I wouldn't criticise them for it. I said, come on, because this is important. Debtors' prisons we have. Taking children away from poor people. I understand it kills people. It fucking kills me. What a selfish prick. This doesn't affect you. Of course it doesn't. What can we do? We can tell people it's going on. We can tell people about Charlotte. Killed. Negligence. And the state tried to cover it up and blame the father for it and wrecked the family. Chased the mother around Europe. Retaliation. because she uncovered information that showed the state colluded in the cover-up of the death of a child back in 2001. And she's paying for it in 2019, because 2 years ago, they took her beautiful daughter away from her. I've seen a picture of the child. And people have to know about it. I don't know. So, if it's affected you, Sharon is on Facebook, and she welcomes people who've gone through it and who want to know more about it with open arms. So get in touch with her through Facebook. It's Sharon with one R, Gale, G-A-L-E. There's only one Sharon Gale. Put Sharon Gale into Facebook. Her name will come up straight away, and connect with her. And you'll meet with other people. And there's a lot to be said for that. If you're despairing, if you're thinking about self-harming, if you're in a really bad place, reach out to the tens of thousands of other people who are going through it. Because it's tens of thousands a year of children being taken away. And a tiny fraction of those children are children who have been sexually abused or battered. The majority are where somebody has picked on a family because of the opinions of the parent, because one of the parents used to have depression, because there used to be drug abuse, risk of future emotional harm, tens of thousands, it's a £1 billion a year industry. And 20,000 kids a year go missing. Look for John Wedger, former police officer. Look for him. 20,000 a year go missing, vanish into thin air. There's so much to this. As Sharon said, it's complex. It's not just about the money. It's about something very sinister besides the money as well. I think she's amazing. I'll get this on social media as quick as I can. And I hope you'll share it. And I hope you'll encourage people to listen to it. I'm going to close out the programme on that thought and say I'll see you tomorrow at 5. I'll be joined tomorrow by an old pal, Mark Windows, will be on the programme live tomorrow. Thanks for listening. And thanks for people like Sharon Gale and every other person who's going through this. I hope programs like this mean something to you. All right. See you soon. Bye now.